Okay, so, right, my name is Sergey. Probably write it down. Okay, well, anyway. So I named this course Monad. It's programming. Yeah, okay. By the way, about my question, is it all right that it's going to be in English? This is my first time that I'm giving it in English, I guess. So, but for me, it's easier. I mean, I could do it in German, but this is more effort for me. I mean, you could do it, but I would need to learn all the terms before, and I'm gonna make lots of mistakes and stumble and stutter, etc. I'm much more fluent in English. So I named the course Monad-based programming, and I'm not sure if you have the right expectation about the word programming. I remember as a student, I've been to the university and I came for the first time to a lecture which was called linear programming or mathematical programming, and lots of people were very frustrated because it was not so much about programming. Actually, it was not about programming at all. Well, this is not true for this case. It's going to be connected with programming, I think, much more than the linear programming. But this shouldn't be understood as coding. We are not going to write programs every day and learn the syntactic details of some particular language. I mean, we are going to do some programming and playing that, but basically as an illustration to the material we are going to learn. I mean, this is my intention at least. So. They are going to learn certain things, and to make it more fun and more easy, we are going to program something. I think nothing very complicated. Basically, I think we will try to stick to Haskell. Because presently, this provides the best background for the things you are going to learn. So the title involves the word monad, and I mean monad is a certain concept which defines your mind about how you do the programming. So it's like classes in C++. So if you learn classes, then you put certain sort of glasses on your face and see everything in terms of objects in classes. You look at the table and say, okay, this is probably an object of some class furniture and so on. Whatever you look at, you try to see it in terms of object and classes, inheritance, virtual inheritance, whatever, virtual functions. So that's a universe. So the universe around monads is not so big, but still when you learn it and when you enjoy it, you try to think in these terms. So you look, if you learn Haskell, if you do it well, and you try to involve monads and you see how doing this and that thing in terms of monads is easier and nicer. So, and yeah, as I said, Haskell provides a support for the monads, and it has quite rich infrastructure in current monads, so we can do many examples with Haskell and put certain things into running with Haskell. There are other languages which support monad in different respects, but they are not very well developed, and Haskell is a very, very well-developed language, and there's a huge community, lots of conferences, lots of developers, lots of people doing it, and it's developing every year. They always design new features, and there are lots of theoretical work in the background, so I'm going to rely on Haskell. Right. What else? So we've got two classes per week. And one, as I learned today, is today. and the second one is on Wednesday. It's supposed that there are like lectures and practicals which should interchange, but I cannot say very well how they will interchange, because in the beginning probably they're just going to be any only lectures. Then, depending how we proceed, there are going to be some practicals, and I think it's, I cannot say that it's going to be one lecture, one exercise. I think the sequence will be a bit more complicated. But tomorrow there apparently going to be one more lecture. What else? Any questions so far? All right. Yeah. So then we can talk about. I mean, recall several things which are going to be relevant for this course, and yeah, I'm not very well prepared. I was going to prepare tomorrow for tomorrow. So just. I can recall certain things from the top of my mind. So a bit informally, so that they're going to be made more formal next. So I could provide a motivation, I mean, for from a practical perspective only, and this is how it's done for programmers. So like for people doing Haskell, you don't go into theory. You just show the first program and say, this is how it is, and show another program, and then you learn things that way. So you don't explain the history, the development, the theory behind. So this is a theoretical course, I mean, half theoretical at least, and I'm a theoretician, so I would prefer to motivate it differently from a different side and show certain theories, some problems, some history, which motivated what I'm going to talk about next from a theoretical perspective. So, and the motivation is comes from the side of semantics. Semantics. So in theoretical programming, we do lots of semantics. So this is something that we do not do in math. I could give you an example. So there was the Gloin course, and recently there was an exam, and an exercise which people hate the most was an example about models and interpretation of terms over models. I don't know how many of you attended, probably pretty many. I think you mostly bought bachelor, no masters. Yeah, I mean, so the Gloin course was redesigned in recent years, and I think not everyone has seen the recent course, but in the recent course, this is quite a typical exercise that we had. We had first order models, and terms are interpreted over these first order models by using a function which is called semantics. So it's a function from terms to meanings. That's a very very abstract characterization of it, because on different occasions, terms are different things and meanings are also different things. But in this first order case, we formed expressions like f, x, and y. So this is a function, and these are two arguments. And to calculate the semantics, what we do is we calculate the semantics of a function, and we calculate the semantics of the arguments, and apply the semantics of the function to the semantics of the arguments. So the arguments are variables. So usually the semantics bracket are parameterized by so-called evaluation function. So sigma goes from vars to, I don't know, what? To M, say. So M is our model. And if we use it as an index here, sigma, 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 and then this sigma tells us what the meanings of the variables is. We just can grab the meaning of variables from the sigma and substitute it. So this is F sigma. Well, actually, we don't need the sigma. Actually, these are two different brackets, because these are brackets for the functions and these are brackets for the variables. So since the semantics of a function doesn't depend on sigma, I just drop it here. Sigma x, sigma y. Right, so this is like the definition that we had in the GLOIN course. And all right. One thing which I would like to mention here is this property. It's called compositionality. It's again an informal concept. In theoretical computer science, there are lots of informal concepts like semantics, compositionality. So in this respect, informatics is different from math, where everything is very formal. So there are ideas and concepts. So the concepts of compositionality, it's a property of the semantics which says that if there is a complex thing, then the semantics of it is composed from the semantics of its parts. So to calculate the semantics of this complex thing, you calculate the semantics of the function and the arguments, and then the whole semantics is the composition of these things. So this is quite important, because, I mean, every text in semantics argues that our semantics is compositional very well. And this is indeed good, because if semantics is compositional, then every reasoning about it is very simplified, because whatever you when you apply semantics to a term, then the result simplifies in a well understood way, and it's easy to prove anything about it. And then I come back to that exercise, this GLOIN exercise, because the point of the exercise was proving something about it. Like if you have a conjunction, and if at least one is bottom, then the whole thing is bottom. It's kind of obvious, but it's just an example. So if a conjunction contains bottom, the false, then the whole conjunction evaluates to false. And this was a very simple exercise about the semantics. So we proved that the semantics satisfy certain properties. Right, and why do we need to talk about it? So if you again compare mathematics and computer science, there is no fuss about the semantics. If you open any complex mathematical books, no matter what it is, if it's a proof of the Poincaré conjecture, they do not tell the meaning and the term and the meaning. If you write 2 plus 2, you do not need to put the semantics brackets around it to claim that it's 4. You just say it's 4. You don't need to put the brackets around. And because precisely this is the point about informatics and about us being informaticians or computer scientists, is that it's important for us to tell a text and a meaning, because we write programs. Program is a text, but we can run a text and execute it and have a result. So you can look at these brackets as like an execution of a program. And this is something that you do not have in pure math. Right. So we use the semantics brackets to connect terms, texts, with their meanings, and sometimes this value which we get by interpreting some text or some term is called the notation. So I can write it more generally. Semantics of T is the denotation of T. And this word, denotation, gives gives the name for this style of semantics. So this what I presented, what I've sketched here, is a particular style of given semantics. By giving the semantics brackets and by defining the meanings of terms in a compositional way, so this is a particular style of semantics which is called denotational semantics. Denotational semantics. So this is a semantics that was developed by two people called Dana Scott. I'm never sure about the pronunciation. Christopher. I'm not sure about the spelling here. And Christopher Strachey, also not sure. Anyway, so these two people developed the whole approach, the whole philosophy about this kind of semantics, and they showed how you can do it in many different occasions, and most notably for the lambda calculus. Because lambda calculus is like an underlying language of theoretical computer science, and if you could do something for lambda calculus, it would be considered as you can do it well. So this probably would work for something else, because the lambda calculus, it contains the most important features. And most complex one, if you can handle it, then you can handle many other things. Yeah. Right. So I don't know how many of you have been to the course of Professor Schroeder, Theory of Programming. Well, I think many. And how many, I mean, apart from that, there are probably people who know about lambda calculus. How many of you know lambda calculus? Okay, this is very good. So probably I do not need to tell much about it. But I mean, I will still recall it a bit. So lambda calculus. If you want to talk about lambda calculus, this is quite easy. So in lambda calculus, it's a term language where we have variables. And terms. So I define the terms by a Beckenbauer form. So this can be a variable, or it can be a lambda abstraction, or it can be an application. I write it like this. So here, I mean, these are these are my terms, which I defined recursively by one of these clauses. So this is the base of the recursion. So here it's supposed to be one of the variables, and these are two induction steps. So it's either I take a term and add a lambda abstraction here, or I apply one term to another. Right. So, and we've got two fundamental equivalence principles about the lambda terms, alpha that is alpha conversion, which tells that lambda x t can be replaced with lambda y and of course it's important here that that y is not free in
fresh.
Yeah. Alternatively, you can say it's fresh. You can weaken this.
If it is bounded.
And fresh is the synonym for not free. Bound is not free. Bound variables are those which are not free by definition. I mean, the point is that we replace x in this term, and if we replace it by y, and y was free in t. Then both the new occurrence of y and the old occurrence of y will be bound by this lambda. And this is what we don't want. We want to bind only the new one and not the old one. So actually we can weaken this rule. We can say something weaker about it. So we could assume that y is here, then we need to rename y into something else, and then we can use this y without restrictions here. But this is an important in certain ways, and it brought up certain interesting theories very recently. But this is not what we're going to study. This you can iterate to reach this effect that this assumption can be weakened, because if you if you use this rule several times, then you can eliminate this effect that y is not free, is fresh, so it can be not fresh, but if you apply it several times, then you can reuse the same variable instead of just saying it's new. Why we call it conversion? Okay, I probably just tell you what beta reduction is first. Beta reduction looks like this. This is substitution. Probably I should have told by this I mean I replace x with t in s. So there is a notation. So sometimes a different notation is used. So sometimes in going course, for example, this notation is used. We send x to t, and here we replace x by t. So it's goes in different directions, but this is denote the same. Questions about
that if we get a bound, a situation in T where
we're talking about alpha conversion, right?
Yes.
Yes.
A situation in T where X is free and Y is bound.
X is free in T?
We have a sub-expression in T where X is free in this sub-expression and Y is bound.
Yes.
And now if we replace X by Y.
Yes.
What was an x is now a bound y.
Yes.
And that's not what we want, right?
It is. I mean, if it was bound, it was bound by a different lambda. So, okay, you could have something like lambda x, lambda y.
Okay.
You want x, right? Ah, okay.
Now if you replace x by y,
The point is the substitution is capture avoidant. Yeah, I didn't detail what the substitution means, but if you replace x by one here by y here, so then the result is lambda z y, something like this, and it's not lambda y x. I mean, yeah, the substitution is defined tricky precisely because we don't want this to happen. I don't know, maybe on the next lecture I can give precisely the definition of the substitution. Yeah, but this is a good point. I should have said that substitution is the substitution is capture avoiding. So capture avoiding means precisely that to eliminate a sort of counterexamples. Yes.
For the better reduction, don't you want to replace x with s?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. That's wrong. T s x. Sorry for that. Anything else? And this we call beta reduction. So right, x occurs in t, and we apply this function to s, which means that we replace this x in t by s in the capture avoiding fashion. So right, there are only two laws, and this is all very very rudimental, very simple. We've got a very simple language and very primitive rules, and this is a very very rich calculus. And in particular, you can do the programming using this only, this sort of language only. And in particular, there are. There is yet another language you might know, which is called Lisp. I think it's one of the first languages ever, and it's not more complicated than this. So, and I'm endlessly surprised why it's still in use, but apparently it still is. And moreover. There are descendants of it. So the modern descendants of Lisp is Scheme. And basically it operates with this sort of expressions and lots of things, lots of concepts. So all whatever you do in the programming can be just encoded in this basis. Because it contains the essence of programming. You've got the notion of function, you've got a notion of argument, you've got a notion of application of a function to an argument, and you've got a notion of renaming. So alpha is renaming. And I should explain why it's called conversion reduction, and this is a very standard practice in the theoretical informatics, which stems from this example. So it's a tradition now that things when you define this reduction relations, then things which are which can be oriented. So we have on the right something which is intuitively simple than on the left, like application. And this can be more complex than this. I will give an example. Mentally, you expect that this reduction is simplifying your term. It may not happen, but this is what your intention is. So that's why you call it reduction. So you reduce the expression to something simpler. And conversion is something that where you've got the left and the right hand side on the same level. So you don't mean that the right-hand side is simpler than the left or the other way around. This is just some bureaucracy. So you rename one variable with another name, and you don't mean that something particular happened. This is just for bookkeeping.
That's actually what surprised me the most about the auth conversion. If we just do very accurate bookkeeping, as coded by ourselves, we don't actually wouldn't need it, or would we?
That's a question. You can replace lambda calculus with another calculator. There is I gave a course in term writing in the previous summer semester where I have discussed all the things at length. So there's another calculus which is called combinatorial logics, and it doesn't have a notion of variable at all. So I don't know if maybe some of you has already done Haskell or languages like this. There is a notion called point free programming. In one paper, I have seen a joking footnote saying not to be confused with point less programming. So yes, there is a style of programming where you didn't have a notion of variable at all, and this is possible, and this is even called a programming style. So when you just write a function and then some other function with a dot and then some other function and so on, and you can avoid variables, and you can do it in Haskell if you want, but the problem is you get incredibly unreadable programs. Well, if you do it properly, then it's helpful. It's like you get some mathematical notation like f of g of h. If it makes sense, you can do it, but still Haskell only provides this as a feature. It's not completely based on this concept. So it's something like a syntactic sugar which you can use. And so this combinatorial logic which I mentioned, it's completely based on pointless programming. Point free programming. I have made the mistake which I warned you against. And it's proven that that it's equivalent to lambda calculus, but for one thing, as I said, it's not that convenient. So really, the variables are convenient. And second, it's more complex. So instead of these two rules, you get a big bunch of rules, and it's much more difficult to understand. So this bookkeeping which you have here, it's very natural. If you're say, okay, I want to develop some smart bookkeeping rules, it turns out that the smart rules are very complex, actually. Unfortunately, this is a bit surprising. It was also surprising to me, but it turns out that the lambda calculus is a really smart idea because it has in a way unavoidable collections of things. If you try to move in one of the directions, then you get something less fortunate. something complex in a different respect. So there are also things called de Bruijn indices, or de Bruijn indices. This is a Dutch name. I don't know how to pronounce it properly. I'm not even sure about the spelling. De Bruijn, I think it's like this. So this is like your number. You just read your term from left to right, and you remember which variable came first. And instead of just like consider this term again, lambda x, lambda y, x. So this is the first variable. This is the second variable. Once you know this, you no longer need the name. So you just can replace it by lambda, and then yet another lambda, and here you can write 2. Yeah, I mean, in theoretical words that has been used, I think for theory this is of some use, but in practice I haven't seen it in any languages apart from this esoteric like brain fog or something, which are just meant to make a programming complex, yes?
I think it's used if the lambda expressions are generated by some kind of compiler or something.
I would expect so, yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, you do it if you just want one expression and you don't mean to do it anything else with it. But the problem is, you actually want, normally you want to do something else with it. You want to somehow transform it. And if you generate it, then you usually introduce the variables. So it's, at some point, you would transform from this to lambda x1, lambda x2, x2. Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to switch from one to the other. But it's difficult to maintain terms like this in all situations you want. All right, so my next plan is to tell you about two other styles of semantics. So the denotational semantics I've sketched, and I've talked about the lambda calculus a bit. Why? Because I want to illustrate another style of semantics, which is called operational semantics. I think we are more or less at the end. So I just announce this term. And the next thing I'm going to do is I want to tell you what operational semantics is and illustrate it using the lambda calculus. This is the second style of semantics, and the difference is the notational semantics tells us directly what a semantics of a program is, and operational semantics tells us how the program behaves. So it tells us about something about the evolution of a program, like this bit reduction. Bit reduction tells us what the next step of a program is. It doesn't tell us about the result. And this is the idea the operational semantics is based on. And the third style of semantics is axiomatic semantics. And axiomatic semantics, in contrast to the previous two ones, tells us not what the meaning of a program is, not what the behavior of a program is. It tells us what properties the program satisfies. So if some of you heard about Hoare calculus or partial correctness assertions, So this is like a mixture of programs and logics where the assertions about the programs tell what properties of the programs are like. You execute a program, and then what? Then there is a predicate saying, then certain properties are satisfied. And this is also a way to give a semantics. And it's quite practically it's quite used because if you want to prove something about your program, prove some complex property about it, not just the result is this, but the result is satisfying some complex property. Right. So this is I'm gonna do tomorrow. I think there are no problems with this. The time, since there are so many people here, no one complains. There's no need to redesign it, right? Okay, any questions then? Yes?
The rule for tomorrow seems to be the tuple in law one.
I don't know, possibly, no. I'm just copied blindly from one place to another. I didn't notice what I've copied. So what's the problem about it?
I was a bit surprised that it
has no blackboard.
Yeah. No blackboard? Yeah, this is actually too bad. It's good that you notice it. I mean, We can just move it right away. I think we can move it to the room on the 11th floor, which belongs to the chair.
Are you sure?
Ah, right. I'm not entirely sure that it's legal. I may ask you to sign some document, like if something happens to you, then I'm not in charge of this. So I don't know. We can do it tomorrow. I mean, I can decide now. I should figure it out if it's possible or not. We can meet there tomorrow and possibly move right after we meet to the 11th floor. Alternatively, I can also bring a whiteboard. We have a mobile whiteboard. I could bring it with me. So it says 155.
Yeah.
And they say there's no blackboard.
Yeah, we can just go down there.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, so the plan is like meet tomorrow in this room and then we will see.